Inside Florida Politics, powered by Gatehouse Florida. Today, the podcast is being anchored from our studio in downtown Sarasota. I'm Zach Anderson, the political editor of the Sarasota Herald Tribune, and I'm filling in for our regular host, George Bennett, who is off today. I'm joined, as always, by John Kennedy, Gatehouse Florida's Capitol Bureau Chief. John is based in Tallahassee, which had some pretty significant impacts from Hurricane Michael. John, I hope everything's okay where you are.
Yes, Zach. Tallahassee was rocked pretty hard by Michael, and the city is pretty much out of power, and it's a little uncertain today as to just when it's going to come back on. It's a tree-loving city, and plenty of them are down.
We'll have a lot more on Hurricane Michael in just a minute. But first, I'm going to introduce two special guests. Joining us from West Palm Beach is Antonio Finns, the political editor for the Palm Beach Post. Welcome, Antonio.
Great to be here.
And our returning podcast champion, Palm Beach Post all-star reporter Christine Stapleton is with us again. Welcome, Christine.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's get right to the big news of the week. We're still trying to get our arms around the damage caused by Hurricane Michael. But we already know this storm had a profound impact on a number of communities in the panhandle. At least two people were killed, a man in Gadsden County who died when a tree fell on his house, an 11-year-old girl in Georgia. I think a lot of people were unsettled by Michael because the storm seemed to come out of nowhere. On Saturday, it wasn't even a tropical storm, and by Monday, it was a hurricane. The storm made landfall between Panama City and Mexico Beach as a devastating Category 4 hurricane with maximum sustained winds of 155 miles per hour and a massive storm surge. It is the strongest hurricane to ever make landfall in October in the continental United States, shattering the previous record of 130 mile per hour winds, and the third strongest storm to ever hit the United States. Michael is also the first Category 4 hurricane to hit the Florida Panhandle. The storm just missed being a Category 5, which is wind speeds of 157 miles per hour or greater. Just watching CNN and scrolling through Twitter, you can tell that the damage was catastrophic for the region between Panama City and Apalachicola. There's a video of Mexico Beach where the water from the storm surge is up to the roofs of the houses and some structures are completely obliterated. And I saw another video of houses just being blown to pieces in Panama City. This is going to be a life-changing event for many people, and it's hard to overstate how devastating these storms can be for individuals and communities. The recovery process can take years, even decades, and it's never fully complete. John, you rode out Michael at your home in Tallahassee. Tell us a little bit about what you experienced and what you're seeing around town.
Well, Tallahassee really got hit by a lot of wind yesterday. It was not anything like the force that struck Panama City and Mexico Beach, but still for Tallahassee, it was significant. A city that's relatively inland when it comes to Florida capital, Florida cities. Today and in the aftermath of the storm, you can see many of the streets are unpassable because of downed limbs. The city was really spared the worst of the damage, though. That happened about 80 miles west of us along the coast. And those communities are really divided between more affluent vacation homeowners and a lot of basically hard scramble local residents who make a living in the fishing industry or in the hometown businesses that cater to those out-of-town visitors. It's sort of a typical Florida story, a lot of haves and have-nots in the state's economy, especially along the coast. And that's a tale that we've seen played out politically in a lot of races this year, with Republicans like Rick Scott and Ron DeSantis running on what they say is the strength of the Florida economy, and Democrats, including Andrew Gillum and Bill Nelson, they seem to talk more about the needs of those left behind in the state's recovery from the recession. Now we have a hurricane to sort of underscore a lot of those kind of divisions.
And John, you actually lost power yourself. You have no electricity at your house. Any idea when you're going to get the power back on? The whole city is dark right now, right?
Yeah, the whole city is dark. About 97% out is what is being reported right now. And as far as bringing it back, it's hard to tell. Pretty significant hurricane 2 years ago, Hurricane Hermine. And some residents were out of power for about 2 weeks after that. So this one, I would say, is worse. So we may see a long duration here without much electricity in the city.
Well, that's no fun. I hope that they get power back on soon and things get back to normal quicker than maybe expected here. Antonio, you're very familiar with this area as well. Can you tell me a little bit about what it feels like to see a place that you love get battered like this?
Well, yeah, quite frankly, it's devastating. And I'm thinking about my friends up there, people like Nate Odom, who runs the Mexico Beach Marina, Frank Nolan and his lovely wife that live there. I did hear from one of my friends there who was actually, he was in Canada and was not able to get back to help to try to at least secure his house and his boat. And he fears he's lost both. And from the images that we saw this morning, those fears may be realized. It's not a place that most Floridians have probably even heard of before the storm, but I got to tell you, it's one of the most special places in the state. It is known for the artificial reef program, and I encourage everybody to go to go to Google and Google the Mexico Beach Artificial Reef Association, ambara.org, and you'll learn about what these very special people have done. And they've created this massive artificial reef system with these concrete pyramids that they drop right off the coast. And a few years ago, when I was there, Nate Odom, who runs the marina, he was selling these T-shirts. For those of you who are shark enthusiasts, you may know of Catherine the Shark, which is a great white that was tagged by Osearch off the coast of the North Atlantic. And for a while, Catherine the Shark actually made a home in Mexico Beach in the artificial reef for about 3 weeks. This must have been about 2014, late 2013. And Nate was selling these shirts about Mexico. It said, Mexico Beach, this place is jawsome. And I got my T-shirt, and I wore it proudly last night.
It is a beautiful area up there, and it's really sad to see the pictures of the devastation. A quote that stuck out to me when I was reading the Associated Press story this morning was from a woman in Apalachicola named Sally Crown, who wrote out the storm in her house. And she said, it's absolutely horrendous. Catastrophic. There's flooding, boats on the highway, a house on the highway. I have a little bit of experience up there going up to Tallahassee to cover the legislature. I would go over to Apalachicola and stay there a little bit. And really just, it's one of my favorite places in Florida. One of the great old Florida towns that reminds you of a different time and place. So it's just really heartbreaking to see all these communities struggling like this. You know, the human toll is what's most important in a situation like this. And our hearts go out to all the people who have been impacted by this storm. People have died. They've lost homes. They've lost businesses. And I just want to pause for a moment and recognize the losses that many people have suffered. We're going to switch gears a little bit now and get into the political ramifications of all this. This is a political podcast, and there's no denying this storm could have significant political ramifications. Many candidates dial back their campaigns to avoid mixing politics with the storm. My email inbox is usually overwhelmed by candidate emails, but I noticed a big decrease during the hurricane. It was actually kind of refreshing, but the politics didn't come to a complete stop during the storm. There was some back and forth about Ron DeSantis, the Republican candidate for governor, continuing to run attack ads against his opponent, Andrew Gillum, in the affected areas during the hurricane. There was also a super PAC supporting Senator Bill Nelson that ran attack ads against Rick Scott. Super PACs, by law, though, are not allowed to coordinate with the candidate. So Nelson didn't really have any control over that. But it just goes to show that it seems like some of these norms are being overlooked here. John, what's your take? Are these candidates supposed to relax on the politicking during a storm like this? I think even Jeb Bush called out the DeSantis campaign and the Nelson campaign to dial back on this and take the ads off the air.
Yeah, there seems to be sort of a custom where something like this is looming, that the candidates decide to just sort of back away from the more conventional campaign ads that they've been running. In this case, the Gillum side was blasting the DeSantis camp for running TV ads about an FBI investigation of Tallahassee city government, which we wrote about last week for Gatehouse Papers. Democrats called it despicable, and they seemed to want to put the governor's race on pause, you know, while the storm was demanding everyone's attention. At one point, several Democrats got on a conference call on the eve of the storm, you know, ridiculing what the DeSantis side was doing. Miami Beach Mayor Dan Gelber called it stupidly partisan. of what DeSantis was doing. But, you know, it's something that both sides are doing it. Zach, you mentioned a moment ago that how the Nelson side have been running an ad against Scott. They're calling him a shady millionaire who doesn't look out for you. Well, that ad was airing as the hurricane was approaching as well. But, and Scott's side has a Republican super PAC that is close to Scott, has been running an empty suit ad against Nelson. So it's one of those things that in different corners of the state, the hurricane seems to be a little bit of a distant event, and I guess the campaigns look at it as we might as well try to reach out to those viewers that are largely unaffected by this hurricane. And meanwhile, a lot of these people that are running for office, especially Scott and to a degree Gillum, managed to get some airtime. They're showing up on the Weather Channel, on CNN, talking about the storm as it's advancing. Bill Nelson, who's running against Scott, he managed to get some airtime, but he got shooed away from the state's Emergency Operations Center in Tallahassee on Monday when he tried to speak to reporters. He was seen as having no official role in the storm prep effort.
Right, and even Craig Fugate, who was Jeb Bush's emergency management director, tweeted out, he said, quote, "I would encourage all Florida candidates running for office to use this time to help raise funds for the Red Cross, Salvation Army, and other groups." So he was even rapping these candidates over the knuckles a little bit, saying this is a major time of crisis. Let's put the politicking aside, but a lot of our political norms have been obliterated in recent years, and this seems to be another one. John, you sort of alluded to it, but can you talk just a little bit more about just the political ramifications of all this? You know, this is a huge, major news event, devastating event for a lot of people, that it's occurring right before an election. A lot of people are saying that this is kind of the equivalent here of an October surprise, and you have two of the major players are running for election. You have Governor Rick Scott, who is responsible for leading the state during this emergency. He's running for the U.S. Senate against Bill Nelson, and you have Andrew Gillum, who's the mayor of Tallahassee, which was impacted by the storm. He's running for governor against Ron DeSantis. Give me your thoughts on how this could impact the governor's race and the U.S. Senate race.
Well, it is one of those events with a really strong political shading. Governor Scott, obviously a candidate for U.S. Senate, he is able to get a major platform with regular briefings and updates as the state was preparing for the storm. And now that we're through it and into the aftermath, this to a degree is a little bit of the wild card for Scott. He looks very efficient and very organized heading into the storm. And now it's really a matter of how does the state recover. It can give the governor a lot of leadership points, I guess, is maybe a way to describe it. If things move smoothly, if voters feel confident in the way he has carried out his role as the state's chief executive and help the state recover, that can be a plus, and that can swing a few votes, undoubtedly, in an election that's less than a month away. Gillum, of course, Andrew Gillum, who is running for governor as a Democrat against Ron DeSantis, the Republican. Gillum caught heat a couple of years ago when many Tallahassee residents were out of power for a week or more after Hurricane Hermine. Even Scott, whose governor's mansion was out of power for a couple of days, he joined in some what kind of looked like passive aggressive criticism. He was going out to help personally clear streets and talk to residents that were out of power. Meanwhile, there was a whole Twitter storm going on about the city's slow response when it came to getting the power back up. Now, the slow response is in the eye of the beholder to a degree, because many communities are out of power for a week or more after a storm as devastating as Hermine was. But Gillum's opponent, DeSantis, he has an ad now running that is critical of the city's 2016 hurricane response. So, you know, for Andrew Gillum, there's a lot riding on him now as to how his city digs out from this storm.
So there's some opportunities from a political perspective for these candidates to look strong, to look like a strong leader. There's also a lot of opportunity to be on television. I saw in a political article, they noted that Scott has been mentioned 5,800 times on television in the approach to Hurricane Michael. So there's a lot of exposure here. People are looking at you, and you're in the spotlight, and that can, really help to make you look like a strong leader if you respond well. But there's some pitfalls here as well. If the power is out for weeks and weeks in Tallahassee, Gillum is the mayor. I mean, he might get some blame for that. So I'm sure he's hoping the power comes back on very quickly. John, we saw after Hurricane Irma that Scott got a pretty big boost in his approval rating. Do you think he could get a similar bump from this if he performs well?
Oh, there is always that possibility that a good result from a storm like this will have an echo, and that's going to be something. Voters in the governor's race and also in the U.S. Senate race seem to be, at least according to polls, they seem to have their minds pretty made up on these candidates. The amount of swing voters that are left is, sort of in the single-digit percentages. So hard to tell how many people are persuadable at this hour, but... it is something. The aftermath of this storm is something that's really going to have some impact on the November 6th elections.
Well, we'll have to wait and see. It'll take probably a week or two to play out and see how these candidates actually perform after the storm here, and whether they're viewed as taking the bull by the horns here and actually getting the relief that people need and getting these communities the help that they desperately need right now. So all eyes will be on them over the next few weeks, and hopefully these communities are able to get back on their feet here. We are going to go to a regular feature in the podcast here, our pick a number segment. We don't want to let that go by the wayside, even though George isn't here this week. So let's go to you first, John. What's your number this week?
Yeah, Zach, my number is 48 this week.
48. All right. Antonio, how about you?
Zach, I'm going to go with 8.3.
8.3. Got it. And Christine, how about you?
I am picking number 4.
Number 4. I'm going to wedge myself right in the middle here. I'm going with number 12. And we'll come back to those numbers at the end of the show. Let's get back to the politics of the storm. Antonio, what's your take on how the politics of weather have evolved? I mean, it's a huge issue here in Florida. Obviously, we're in the hurricane zone here. Is this something that can have a big impact on an election or someone's political career in general, if they perform well during a hurricane or if they perform poorly?
Sure. And I think that it's interesting that we're having this discussion, because the turning point for the politics of weather, and particularly the politics of hurricanes, was here in Florida in 1992 with Hurricane Andrew. And the moment where it all turned was when the Kate Hale, who was then the director of the Miami-Dade Emergency Services Department, called out the H.W. Bush administration, Bush 41. And she said, where the hell is the cavalry? And the idea being that, we just got clobbered, where's our help? And up until that point, there wasn't really you didn't really assess the federal government response to a hurricane. For example, in 1960, I've never heard of anybody saying that, Richard Nixon lost to JFK because of the poor response to Hurricane Donna, or in 69 after Hurricane Camille. I don't think anybody's ever said that was the black stain on, Governor Claude Kirk at the time and his administration. So up until that point, it really wasn't a political issue. But after Andrew, this became the debate changed on hurricane response, where it was seen as this is the moment where the government needs, the federal government only has the resources to come in and deal with a disaster of this magnitude. And for Florida, that's been the case all along. We have, often looked at the response to a hurricane, and there's been so many of these in the last, particularly the last 15 years or so, that it has become a way to really judge not only the effectiveness of the public sector, but also how we see the empathy of the person in charge. I remember, George W. coming down with Jeb in the early 2000s and handing out bags of ice after some of the storms then. And I think, interestingly, presidential election between Bush 41 and Bill Clinton, and interesting, despite the criticism of the slow federal response, Bush 41 carried Florida that year. But it's changed dramatically, and particularly you look at, the response of his son, Bush 43, with Katrina in New Orleans. And the kind of flack that he took there because of the perceived slow response to dealing with that disaster. Now, the interesting thing, that's how it's kind of evolved. The interesting thing going forward is going to be how this becomes a kind of a generational issue, particularly between older, more conservative voters and younger more, shall we say, progressive voters, because, you know, I think that there is a perception growing right now that some of these storms are becoming very powerful because of the ocean temperatures warming. And climate change is an issue that particularly younger voters have expressed, you know, more, a greater concern about, let's say, than some of the older voters who look at, okay, you know, this is going to happen 30, 40, 50, 60 years down the line. It's not a present day issue for me. But if there is a consensus that does form that, in fact, the impact of climate change is the serious life-threatening and certainly property-threatening hurricanes and the number of them and more importantly, the intensity of them, I think all of a sudden this issue that has always been sort of characterized as take action now to avoid some apocalypse or some devastating impact, perhaps decades down the line, in terms of coastal flooding and, you know, and encroaching oceans and coastlines, I think all of a sudden becomes a very immediate danger and a present day danger, and one that may start changing political attitudes very quickly.
Yeah, you make a good point. There's the immediate political impact of how you perform during this crisis. And there's also the long-term questions here. Are you planning for the impacts of hurricanes? Are we planning for sea level rise? Are you, you know, taking steps as a governor or as a state legislature to, you know, make it so that after the storm, you know, the recovery process goes faster? We saw after Irma, the legislature, you know, there was a big problem down in South Florida with a nursing home there where a number of people died in a nursing home that lost power after the storm. And it was a big issue for Scott. And there was a back and forth over whether, you know, that they said that they called him and asked for help. And he said he never got a request for help. But it certainly motivated him and the legislature to put in some new rules in place to make sure that nursing homes have backup power generators so that they can have air conditioning after a storm. So how you respond, not just in the immediate aftermath, but in the long term to make sure that these problems don't happen again, can really be a test of leadership as well. And I remember when Jeb Bush was running for president, you know, he really pointed to his time in Florida in 2004 and 2005 when he was tasked with responding to 8 hurricanes as a real feather in his cap in terms of leadership and being able to help the state recover from that. So it just shows he ran for president in 2016. The last of those hurricanes hit in 2005. So 11 years later, he was still talking about his performance during the storm and holding that up as an example of his leadership. So it does seem like these things have become important parts of people's political careers and an important test of leadership. But we're going to move on now. There wasn't a lot of political news this week because of Michael. Most of the candidates were laying low. But before the storm started dominating, the big focus was really on Brett Kavanaugh's nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court. Kavanaugh was sworn in on Monday. Christine, Florida's 2 senators are not on the Senate Judiciary Committee, but you reported on the bitter fight over Brett Kavanaugh's nomination process. What did you find?
Well, I think one of the most interesting stories that came out of this was the impact that it had across the country on victims of sexual assault. And what we saw here in Palm Beach County was a dramatic increase in the number of rape exams that were performed in the 12 days after Dr. Ford came out with her story, her accusations against Judge Kavanaugh. And we heard reports also from around the country. CNN had a lot of callers calling in, reporting. We had the Rape, Abuse, and Incest Network nationwide saw an unprecedented spike in the number of calls. And they're attributing, the sexual assault experts are attributing this to Dr. Ford coming forward. But now there's an interesting impact that could result from this that has a real downside. And that is with the approval of Judge Kavanaugh and his being sworn in, you could see sexual assault victims actually coming to the conclusion that it isn't worth coming forward. I mean, look what happened to Dr. Ford. Look how the president mocked a sexual assault victim. So what experts are worried about now is that actually you may see a decrease and that people may not be willing to come forward with complaints. And it will be interesting because we are expecting data from the state in the next week So we will see if there has been an increase or decrease. Every month, the sexual assault agencies around the state have to report the number of calls, the number of rape exams, and we will be getting those data and following up on those to see the impact that the Kavanaugh hearings did have on sexual assault victims statewide.
Another bit of political news that snuck in there before Michael was President Donald Trump's visit to Orlando, which you mentioned, Christine, you covered that event. He touched on Kavanaugh and a bunch of other things. What stood out to you?
I think the most important thing that came out of that were his comments about Judge Kavanaugh. I mean, he went so far as to call the judge a flawless person. And then he went on to say that the people who opposed Judge Kavanaugh were evil. And he got a resounding response from the crowd, a lot of applause when he went through his comments on the judge and praised the judge and his character. 40 minutes that he spent with the International Association of Police Chiefs conference in Orlando. And, you know, you can't help but think when you hear these types of comments from the president or from the left and the right that, you know, Putin and the folks in the GRU, the Russian spy agency, are high-fiving each other whenever these kind of comments come out, because the entire purpose of their misinformation, disinformation campaign is to spread discord among the American populace. So anytime you have these comments in any context, any political situation being spoken, it splits the American public and does exactly what the Russians are trying to do.
You know, Zach, it's also important to note that this event that Christine covered, you know, this was not a political rally. He was speaking to the International Association of Police Chiefs. And when you get into the issue that what Christine was describing, sexual assaults, well, if you are a victim of a sexual assault, who do you report it to? Well, your local law enforcement. And here was the president talking to this association of police chiefs, basically, you know, making the case that that this was an completely unfounded charge. There was no reason to have believed it. And, you know, and he seemed to have gotten applause. And to go to Christine's earlier point about, you know, will this, or at the end, dissuade individuals from coming forward? Boy, you know, that was quite a scene on Monday.
And I think, too, to John's point there, you know, women voters are really watching what's happened with, you know, with the Kavanaugh situation. And, you know, these types of comments, could they bring women to the polls? And I'll tell you, the women I know, this has really energized women, and women have really, that I've spoken with, they are going to the polls, and this is an issue that's really inspired them. So, you know, the politics behind this and the president's continued comments about it, there could be a big backlash against the Republican Party.
Yeah, we talked about the obliteration of norms when it comes to attacking your opponents on television during a hurricane, and obviously President Trump has no problem, you know, setting aside norms and calling your opponents evil at an official event is not something that probably most people are used to. It's pretty unusual for sure. All right, we're going to wrap up now with our pick a number segment here, and I'm going to go from highest to lowest. John, I think you had a 48. You want to explain that?
I did. Yeah, 48 is the number of officials that Governor Rick Scott reportedly telephoned on the eve of Hurricane Michael hitting Florida. The day before Michael was ready to make landfall, Scott was working the phones. These were mostly city and county emergency officials, police, government leaders across the panhandle. They even ranged as far as St. Petersburg. He also talked with Brock Long, the FEMA administrator, and U.S. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross. But it shows the kind of, you know, get busy approach that Scott has put to preparation for Hurricane Michael. As a politician, you never want to look like you're not on top of a potential disaster threat, so you better cram your schedule with meetings and phone calls and make a point about alerting the media to your involvement. Now bear in mind, this is the same governor whose daily schedule is usually famously unreliable, and who, as a U.S. Senate candidate, he's also failed to make public any kind of daily campaign schedule. But when it comes to hurricanes, you want to let everybody know that you're very busy.
Yeah, I think his official schedule as governor during the campaign has been pretty empty. I mean, obviously, he's been campaigning a lot, but during a hurricane, you definitely want that official schedule to be packed. So, all right, I had the next highest number here with 12. 12 is the number of interviews with national networks that Andrew Gillum did yesterday, according to a tweet I saw from Lawrence Maurer, who's a political reporter with the Tampa Bay Times. He did 6 interviews on CNN, 2 with the Weather Channel, 2 with MSNBC, 1 with NBC, and 1 with ABC. So Gillum getting a lot of national exposure on television during this hurricane. It just goes to show that this is in some ways a political opportunity where you get some attention, you get on TV, you're seen as a strong leader. It could have an influence in the election if people take away from that that you know, you've done a good job during this storm. Next, we have Antonio with an 8.3. You want to explain that, Antonio?
Yeah, 8.3% is the current unemployment rate in Hendry County. Hendry County is the county just to our west here in Palm Beach County. And the reason I point that out is because this is a state that is so much attention is focused on the coastline, you know, South Beach and beaches and pretty areas and wonderful natural areas, that we forget that there's a middle Florida, a rural Florida, that has largely been, you know, left out in the cold when it comes to economic revivals, and particularly after the last recession. Hendry County has 8.3% unemployment rate. That's twice the state average, and certainly more than twice the national number of 3.9%. So as we head into this election, and we wonder, how does a maverick, Donald Trump, who says so many outrageous things, how does he manage to win, as he did in 2016, 58 of Florida's 67 counties? And it's because he did speak to this middle Florida, this large sector of Florida that has been really left out in the cold and forgotten, and not one that you see a lot of investment, you see a lot of attention given to. So, you know, if you want to turn the tide on the politics of this state in particular, you need to start paying attention to Florida. And you can start doing that by reading the story that Jeff Ostrowski and our staff did about a week ago about Hendry County and why it's struggling and where its hopes are for recovery.
And a lot of the communities that were impacted by Michael are rural communities up there. You know, Panama City is probably the most developed area in Tallahassee, but a lot of that storm really passed over a lot of communities that are rural and have struggled in the economy, and this will only add to it. So hopefully as they rebuild, there's some efforts for people to try and get back to work. Christine?
Number 4 is the number of lifeguards in Palm Beach County who were not able to work because of respiratory issues. Now, things do seem to be getting better with the red tide. Some of the recent counts they've taken show a reduction in certain areas and even on the west coast of Florida. But what's really going to be interesting in the next week or so is before the hurricane, Hurricane Michael, the red tide had been spotted as far northwest as the panhandle. And it'll be interesting to see how the hurricane impacted the red tide that's been seen up there. Will it disperse it, or is it going to make it worse and perhaps spread it to other Gulf states?
Yeah, good point. You know, the red tide was really one of the dominant political issues before this hurricane, and all the candidates were having to express their environmental bona fides here. It'll be interesting to see if this puts that on the back burner a little bit, if this, you know, actually disrupts the red tide. So that could be another impact on the election. Well, that wraps up our podcast this week. I want to thank everyone for joining us again. George will be back in the host seat next week. And until then, thank you very much.